We will call the meeting to order. This is State Government Finance for Tuesday, March 13th, 2012. Since we now have a quorum, we will consider the minutes. You have before you the minutes of the March 8th meeting. Would someone move those minutes?
Don't move.
Moved by Gunther, Representative Gunther. Any additions or corrections to those minutes? Hearing none, all in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. We first of all have two bills related to the same project here. And members, you have a new sheet showing all of the bonding requests that have come through our committee. And if you're like me, I've already filled mine out for everything we've heard so far, but now I'm going to have to transfer it to this new sheet because there are a couple additional items that have been put on this sheet. So sorry about that, but I'm going to have to transfer my notes over as well. And what we want to do at the end of the day today is to collect these from you, ask you to put your name on it if you would, and turn those in. And we will tally those and send the results on to the Capital Investment Committee. They have requested that we get that to them this week, and so we want to comply with that. Our first two bills are House File 2157 and House File 2601. Since they are a little bit different but the same subject, we'll take them both. I will move House File 2157 to be laid over for possible inclusion, and we will be forwarding that, as I mentioned, to the Capital Investment Committee. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. House File 2157, some of you may recall seeing a bill previously on this. This is Bemidji Veterans Home project, and I know we had it in the last bonding year, a couple years ago, and we're continually modifying and trying to make this just the project that it needs to be for our veterans in northern and northwest Minnesota. You may know, and I've got some testifiers here. You may remember, be aware that we've got 30,000 plus veterans up in our area that don't have the services that they need and deserve, and we're very much pushing to have this veterans home up in our area. And I'd like to, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure how you want to handle this, but if you want to, should we move Representative Hancock's bill as well
okay.
And go forward with that, and perhaps Representative Hancock, I know he's got another bill up, another committee, wants to say a few words, and then we can have our testifiers proceed.
Right. Representative Hancock is co-author of 2157 and the author of 2601, and so I will move House File 2601 for consideration and with the intent of passing on our recommendations to Capital Investment. Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Like Representative Purcell said, this is a project that is not brand new. It's evolving, and I think you will hear shortly from the county commissioners and others just how far this has advanced. And what the 2601 would do would be to provide a next step for us to continue to develop the concept if the bonding money is not there this year for the project, then we're requesting an appropriation of $250,000 for a pre-design. And that is the purpose of this bill, as a way to continue the project to go forward. And,
I understand you've got several testifiers that would like to come before the committee and We'll start.
Mr. Chair, I'll let them introduce themselves at this time, and you notice we've got some posters up here with some pictures. I apologize, you all may not be able to see those as well as we'd like, but please feel free to stand up and take a look.
Good morning, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Joe Vinny. I'm a Beltrami County Commissioner, first Vice President of the Association of Minnesota Counties, Chair, Northern Minnesota Veterans Task Force, and member, National Association of Counties, Veterans and Military Services Task Force. With me today, Chairman and members, are Beltrami County Board Chair, Quentin Fairbanks, and Dr. Ralph Morris, who you will hear from momentarily. We're here today in conjunction with Planning for the Future Care of Veterans, the Band of Brothers and Sisters of the United States Armed Forces, meeting the health care needs of 400,000-plus veterans in the state of Minnesota, from World War II to Korea to Vietnam to the recent Gulf War deployments. It is important for us to remember that veterans remain banded together. They serve together, they identify with one another, and they remain together in mind, body, and spirit. There is a comradeship among veterans, unlike any other, that cannot be broken. Veterans and their attendant needs for health care have been sustained and earned in defense of our country and our freedoms, and were met with great sacrifice. Veterans should never be identified as an entitlement group. Rather, veterans have earned their due by their military service, and it must therefore be the fulfillment of our promise to care for those who have placed themselves in harm's way in military service to their country and who now need or will need a continuum of specialty care. Veterans and their needs must be met whenever and wherever they are found to live throughout the state of Minnesota and throughout the United States of America. I might mention, too, that we are working in close concert on our project with Commissioner Shelliteau, the Department of Veterans Affairs in the state of Minnesota, and his staff. In northern, northwestern Minnesota, we have identified upwards of 30,000 veterans in need of access to care provided in veterans' homes, which should be found to be located in reasonable proximity of veterans. The geographic vastness of northern northwestern Minnesota, thousands of square miles, finds 30,000-plus veterans situated 2, 3, and 4 hours away from pre-existing veterans' homes, away from their communities, away from their families, away from their livelihoods. Surely, reasonable access to veterans' home care is not an unrealistic expectation. We respectfully submit that our advocacy for the siting of the next Minnesota Veterans Home in Beltrami County, Bemidji, and for the broad region of northern northwestern Minnesota meets a most compelling needs justification. We're appreciative of the opportunity to share with you today relevant factual bearings for the northern Minnesota Veterans Home concept and for a Bemidji location of the next Veterans Home in Minnesota. The duty now to take care of veterans is ours. And at this time, then, Mr. Chair and committee members, I would defer to Commissioner Fairbanks.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record, Commissioner.
The Chair, members, my name is Quentin Fairbanks. I'm Beltrami County Commissioner and have been for 12 years. I'm a tribal member of the Red Lake Band of Chippewa Indians, and I'm a veteran of the Korean War. Beltrami County has the two largest Indian reservations within its boundaries, and we also have one in our service area. Our area has the largest population of Indian veterans in the state of Minnesota, if not in the United States. And this fact we're very proud of. The Indian veteran is a very proud, patriotic, family-oriented person. He or she have a great feeling for the family. And we are in a situation in northern Minnesota. Any services we have outside of a clinic, we have to drive 3.5 to 5 hours to get such service. And this is why it's so important that we have a facility that will handle these people where they can have their family close by. So we ask you to consider our request here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. And
next, Mr. Chair, committee members, is Dr. Ralph Morris, if you please.
My name is... good morning. My name is Ralph Morris. I'm a retired Army Medical Corps officer. I'd like to talk a little bit about veterans in Minnesota. We have approximately 400,000 veterans in the state. They are composed of really three waves of veterans. The first wave is the veterans of World War II and the Korean War. The second is the Vietnam era veterans. And then finally, we have a third wave of veterans of the young soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. Of those 400,000 veterans, we have identified approximately 30,000 in northwestern Minnesota who really do not have access to the veterans' homes in the rest of the state. The waiting times for those present homes varies anywhere from 3 to 6 months. If you look at this large poster that we have in front of the table here and draw a line between Fergus Falls and Duluth, you can see that there's a vast area of the state that really does not have access to a veterans home for the veterans or their families. We have been working on this project for about 4 years. The first step really in getting a veterans home is to find land that can be donated to the state for building of a home. In this second poster, and it's all, this poster is also on the third page of your packet, but you'll see the highlighted area. This is a aerial map of Bemidji, and the highlighted area is 15 acres that has been committed by Stanford Health to the building of the sixth veterans home in the state of Minnesota. If you look at the details of the map, you'll see that it's located right next to the Sanford Bemidji Regional Medical Complex. It is also located near major transportation points, including highways and the airport, as well as shopping and other amenities. Also located in Bemidji is a federal VA community-based outpatient clinic. Quite frankly, we don't feel that we could have a better location of a veteran's home than this location almost anywhere in the state in terms of proximity to health and clinic facilities as well as other community amenities for the veterans. I would like to just mention on a personal note, I spent 29 years in uniform. My last service was in the Minnesota National Guard. I had two experiences in the Guard that really made an impression, at least on me. The first was I had the privilege to represent General Shelato in 2007 on the Governor's Veterans Long-Term Care Task Force. Serving on that task force, I came to realize how vitally important these veterans' homes are to veterans and their family, and what a vital service it provides to these people. The second experience I had, and this was actually in the last few months of my service in the Guard, was I did post-deployment physicals on the young veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. And building a sixth veterans home in the state of Minnesota is truly going to be planning for the future for these soldiers. They have just a multitude of problems that are going to be needed to be dealt with in the future, and a home like the one that we want for northern Minnesota will really fill that need. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor, and Commissioners. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard relative to either of these bills? If not, any final comments from Representative Purcell or Representative Hancock?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I just want to elaborate, if I may, just briefly on a comment that Commissioner Fairbanks said, and rightly so, about the men and women veterans in our area. And that's so important because particularly among the Native population, the women have served at a higher rate than anywhere else. And it's something that I think needs to be pointed out. Thank you. I appreciate your support.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Vinnie or Mr. Morris, you mentioned you're working in concert with Commissioner Shalto, and I was just wondering if you know whether they have staff, people to put in, or, you know, if this was to go forward, do they have the complement of individuals that would be necessary to meet the needs of this facility?
Dr. Morris or Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, committee members, that is a work in progress. We're working closely with the State Department of Veterans Affairs, and over time that need accommodation would be met in the planning process. Dr. Morris, please.
I think obviously adding a sixth veterans home to the state would require additional staff in the Department of Veterans Affairs. They don't, I'm not aware that they have staff availability to staff a present home.
Thank you.
Any other questions from committee? If not, thank you, Representative Purcell and Representative Hancock and testifiers. Appreciate your being here.
Thank you for this opportunity, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will move next to House File 1977. Representative Drazkowski. I will move House File 1977. That would be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning. House File 1977 is simply a bill that it's completely permissive in nature. Nothing required here. All it does is sends a signal to from the legislature to the executive branch that we would like them, when the opportunity arises in situations where layoffs are imminent, to call up the union and try to enter into negotiations to look at unpaid leave or reduction in hours in lieu of layoffs. That's all the bill does. There is not a fiscal note for it. That's really all I have for introducing the bill, Mr. Chair.
Any questions from committee? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard relative to House File 1977? Seeing that no one wishes to be heard and no questions from committee, I will renew the motion that House File 1977 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The bill moves forward. Thank you, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Members, we're going to move up consideration of House File 2655. Representative Davids. Welcome, Chair Davids, and I will move House File 2655, that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Tax Committee. Representative Davids.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 2655 very simply establishes a 25% income tax credit for investment in film expenditures in the state of Minnesota. If you have taken a look at the Minnesota Film and TV sheet here, it'll probably be passed out there. There's one thing here that we just need to correct at this point, because it says on the sheet that it's 25% of qualified investment up to $250,000 in the bill. That's not in there at this point. So I just want the two to match up for where we're at right now. So I have with me, Mr. Chairman, Lucinda Winter, Executive Director of the Film Board, to make a few comments, and then we'd stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Winter, please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair Lanning and members of the committee. My name is Lucinda Winter, and for the past 5 years, I've been the executive director at Minnesota Film and TV, which is our state's film commission. And during that time, the purpose for the investment tax credit is as a complement to our Snowbait Film Production Jobs Program, which is an incentive offered to production companies after economic activity has occurred here, production is finished, and we then take a look at all of their financial records, make sure everything's been paid before we move forward with issuing any reimbursement for expenses. This is designed as a complement to that and as another tool for me to in our office to use in selling Minnesota as a place to bring production dollars and production activity. It would be you could use it whether you're a Minnesotan or not in terms of being an investor. The purpose being though that all of the investment money be used for production in Minnesota. So it's really designed as a complement, and there are very few states that have this. However, our sister state Iowa has a program like this, and that's where a lot of the language came from. And when I started watching what kind of response they were getting, I decided it would be worth a shot at seeing if we could make this work here. It would make us very competitive in terms of other states, because we would be one of the first states out with one of these. The reason for this, to be honest, is because our industry is in a state of contraction. My job is to help create jobs for people in our states, to retain employment in our industry in our state, and to grow employment in our state and bring more money here in production-related activity. And I recently had a public policy analyst take a look at the state of our industry, and although some of the decline can be attributed to the recession, our gross domestic product for the 5121, which is our industry code for motion picture and television production, has declined slightly between 97 and 2009. It hasn't grown, even though the industry itself is in a state of growth. Other states, territories, and jurisdictions are growing, and we are not. We're stagnant. Our employment has dropped from 5,000 people employed in this industry in 2000 to 3,800 in 2011, just to give you a couple examples. One other example I'll give you is the number of firms. And our number of firms in Minnesota, this is a two-quarter average, went in 2000 from 500 to 2011, 350. So we're experiencing a contraction, and that is relative to other states. And this is really, as I see it, a tool that I can use to attract production to Minnesota. Producers and production companies come here for two reasons, money and money. If they can get money from us in terms of an incentive, and we're very uncompetitive in the amount of money in our Snowbait account, that will draw new production here. And if investors find also that this is an attractive place for them to work, they will work here. So this would be used for independent films, which is the kind of films that are largely being made now. And it's just it's an additional tool for our office to use that would be very useful in attracting new production to our state.
Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And
I like to see efforts to revitalize the film industry in Minnesota. I was just wondering, Representative Davids, if you've talked to the tax chair about this and what his position is on this money.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Chair Erdahl. Things are looking good.
Thank you.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Davids, thanks a lot for bringing this bill. I think it's something that we need to explore and be more serious about. I've been involved in the past in some of these efforts as well. And thanks, Ms. Winter, for coming here. There's one other thing, though, that I don't think you mentioned, or if you didn't, I didn't hear it. Mm-hmm. An added advantage is we in Minnesota have an outsized film industry here already. A lot of people don't know. We have a lot of producers, scouts,
right.
others who are involved in the film industry. They work out of their homes or out of right. businesses here in Minnesota. And so unlike some other states, maybe Iowa, maybe others, when a film crew comes here, there's a ready-made infrastructure, more so than many, many other states. And some of us remember a few years ago, even movies whose stories are set in Minnesota, we couldn't land.
Right, exactly.
For example, Gran Torino with Clint Eastwood, that was supposed to be filmed in St. Paul. The story was supposed to have taken place here in the Twin Cities, but because we didn't have a competitive incentive package, among other reasons, I'm sure, that movie was filmed in Detroit. And so the storyline was changed to accommodate that new set of facts. So we have some built-in, you know, we have a thriving creative class here that would really benefit.
Exactly.
Ms. Winter?
Thank you, Chair Lanning. And Representative Simon is exactly right. We have a base here and have had for years, for many, many years, since the 80s, of people who are making commercials. They are making lots of corporate and more so corporate video and film. Just for an example, Best Buy, which is just one of the top of the 20 Fortune 500 companies that's based here, spends more than $20 million a year on corporate production, and that is largely going to paychecks for entrepreneurial people who are they're engaged in makeup, production design, teleprompting, script writing, directors of photography. It's a very entrepreneurial industry, and that is, and to some degree, migratory. They will go where the work is to some extent, but we have a great base here, and it's really formed by the companies that work here who for years have made commercials here through the agencies that have sprung up. They make lots and lots of corporate television, and now more and more so, there's more and more digital work going on. We just did a 3D conference here, and there's going to be another 3D production happening in our state, an IMAX production. So we have a base here, and what I'm really worried about, frankly, is erosion of that base, because Best Buy, Ameriprise, Target, they don't have to work here. They are global companies. They can work anywhere, and I want to keep their corporate production here, and the same people who work for them during the week, either as a freelancer or on staff, are also the people who are going to work in independent feature work and work in documentary work to make a living here in the creative class. Many people wear many hats, and they put together good careers that way. So my interest is in not only holding our GDP steady at about $220 million a year, I'd like to see it grow. And we have to reach out and bring in more production, and frankly, some of that has to do with incenting the industry this way.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one follow-up. I remember about 3.5 years ago when A Serious Man was filmed here. The Coen brothers, obviously, you know, treasures from Minnesota, from St. Louis Park, I might add. And that almost, though that was obviously set here because it was autobiographical to some extent about their childhood in St. Louis Park and in Minnesota, that almost didn't get made here. And the Coen brothers, as I understand it, had to really pitch the studios hard to come here because it just wasn't as competitive. Finally, they won, and they probably made a lot less money than they ordinarily would have, but that was sort of a charity case almost. And the one thing I noticed when I was able, because one of the series of scenes was filmed not far from where I live, and I got to go over there, first time I've ever been on a first and only time I've ever been on a movie set, it was fascinating, is you see the economic effects, you see the catering trucks, you see the lighting equipment, you see the other vehicles that are leased locally by local companies, this huge operation that moves from place to place as the film gets made. It was fascinating to me, and those are real people and real vendors and real jobs, and that was really impressive to me.
And that's exactly
Ms. Winter?
Right. Chair Lanning and Representative Simon, it's really true, and just because since I took this job, I have learned how to just have statistics, you know, spew statistics that I never thought I ever could before. Sirius Man spent about $6.5 million in the state, and during production, there were about 150 people. And when during production is really about a four-month period of time. They work here before, they work here during, they work here after. One other interesting anecdotal result of that was that Enterprise Downtown, the Downtown Enterprise Rental Company, the one that's down on about 10th and Marquette, said that Sirius Man was their single largest rental client during the entire year. And the same is true for the hotels where they put people up. So it's a quick and that film took I worked very closely with their producer to bring that film here. We were neck and neck with Wisconsin to get that film here. The producers, even if you are Clint Eastwood, because his producer took Gran Torino to Michigan, or if you're the Coen brothers, you don't really decide. The people who decide where your movie is made is the people who are financing the film. So I work with film financiers and with their producer to encourage production here. Once they got here, they were able to shave 10 days off production because it's so easy to move around in our metro area, which is a big plus for us. It's something I sell on. So 10 days every day in a film of that size represents about $125,000 or $150,000. So every day you can save is like money in the bank. So we have a lot of benefits for shooting here. Right now I'm working with a film that would shoot in August that's about, well, at least double the size of Sirius Man, if not more. And it is a film written by a Minnesotan. The book was published by, it's called Flim Flam Man, if anyone knows about it. Written by a Minnesotan, a woman currently working at NPR. And that screenplay has been optioned, and they're now putting the financing package together. It would shoot in August. It would bring probably $12 to $15 million to the state. And this is the kind of tool that I can use to make sure it's made in Minnesota, because it should not be made in Michigan. It should be made here. It's a Minnesota story. It's autobiographical, and they've got an A-lister director and A-list talent attached. So I just found out this week that they're being greenlit. So this is the kind of tool I need to bring that in.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, first my question to Representative Simon is, did you get in the movie? Because a friend of mine was in it.
Madam Chair, I
Representative
did not.
Simon.
I was just a lowly observer, but our own Representative Hornstein did make it in the movie, I think for just like a second. He does. There's some scene in a dentist's office or something like that where I think he's in it very briefly.
Well, my friend Ari Hopman had one of the big parts. He was the chairman of the department. But aside from that, I'm totally supportive of this support of the film industry. I don't think we've done enough. But what is the, has there been analysis about doing this as opposed to just increasing what we do with snowbait? Has snowbait, is that always used to its maximum? I understood your argument about the investors right. making the decision, but the investors must also look at factors like snowbait as right. part of their decision-making process.
Ms. Winter?
Chair Lanning and Representative Kahn. Yes, the problem with snowbait is it's competitive in terms of being 15 to 20%. That's actually not bad. Some states are at 25 and, frankly, some are at 40. Where I have challenges with snowbait is that we do not fund snowbait to the degree that other states do. And I'll only give you one example because it always sticks with people. The state of Pennsylvania has a $75 million fund a year for their production incentive program, and Ohio recently passed $20 million a year. Ohio does not have the crew base or any of the infrastructure that we have, but they've been able to attract a lot of production. So in lieu of having, so my challenge as the person who's really supposed to lead the charge in growing in the industry is if we can't fund snowbait competitively, what other tools can I use? Because investment credit will also attract production. It's just a challenge for us to appropriate enough funds in the current economic climate for us to be truly competitive with Snowbait. For example, the film I'm talking with right now, I could not provide them with the reimbursement through Snowbait because I don't have the funding for it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that was my question. I mean, this is, after all, even if it's a tax credit, it's all money. And would we be better off putting more money into Snowbait than going into this new program? Remember, I'm a tax and spend liberal, so I really think we ought to fund both of them. I don't have any problems doing that, but unfortunately I'm not in charge, so we don't get to do everything I want to do. But
my answer, Representative Conan and Shirley, my answer to that is that my vision for this is that we have a production incentive to attract production complemented by an investor credit, because then legacy money for Minnesota filmmakers specifically to grow our indigenous industry. This is an elegant, you know, three-legged stool that in my head sounds great, but the realities are that it will work as a package very, very well, and Iowa had worked to sell both. So in other words, if you invest in a film and have no interest in the production company end of it, the investor on a film or investment group on a film could receive this credit, while where the production company would receive the production credit, and it's attractive to both parties, giving them two reasons to come to your state. Because we would be one of the first states doing this. I have talked to George Temple, and he's working on a fiscal note for this. We think that at least for the first couple years, while we're ramping this up and selling it, and it would probably be fairly negligible. But would I love to see us provide more support to Snowbait? Absolutely, it's the coin of the realm, and it's the environment I'm working in.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Conn.
You know, I would think, as I understand Snowbait, and I never pretend to be a tax expert, but we don't give anything out until the company is here making money that would not have otherwise gone to the state. And I think giving something for administrative costs, anything up to 90%, to me makes sense, because it's something you can clearly show comes only because, you know, if we didn't have the money coming in, we wouldn't give it out. And so, whereas, you know, I like that. That one seems much more direct. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand what factors go into not doing that completely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that there's no backlog, because, well, he is Mr. Tax Chairman's here, so he can tell us. Because, you know, it just seems as if it's the balance, the arithmetical balance sheet seems to completely work out.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I would rather, you know, although particularly if this cost is going to be negligible to start it up, I wouldn't mind it. But I'd like to see a really good analysis as to which one has more effect. And I'd like to see us, you know, that's directed to the tax chairman. Obviously, you agree with me. I'd like to see us doing very much more on Snowbait, because I see no downside on doing that. And you got to figure out some creative accounting so it doesn't look like an appropriation. We'll do it in that back row today.
Ms. Winter, Chair Davids, any reaction to that?
I would thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just say I've learned much from Representative Conn over the years, and will continue to learn.
Well, just, you know, Mr. Chairman, you don't have to spend so much time learning. Just do what I tell you to do.
There you go.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to present another one of the great St. Louis Park schisms, where Representative Simon and I part company on a major issue. I can't even remember what the other ones are, but there are a couple. They're well known. Right to work? Yeah. I'm more strongly opposed than he is. you know, Ms. Winter, I appreciate why you're here and that you're bringing this forward for a good reason. You have an industry to protect. But Representative Davids, I always thought that Republicans were all for the free market. And, you know, I don't know why your bill is in the State Government Finance Committee.
Yeah.
It's kind of more of a tax issue, so I'll try to be more an understudy to Representative Lincheski on this. But if it makes sense to allocate capital to make films in Minnesota, the market will do that. If it doesn't, it won't. And asking everyone else in the state to chip in and pay for filmmaking in Minnesota, absent some larger public purpose, doesn't make a lot of sense. Bemidji was just in, and we could have had a sweater vest subsidy, the Santorum sweater vest subsidy. There are all kinds. I mean, it's endless. We don't. For example, if you want to run a ski run in Minnesota, if you want to open up a place to go skiing, you don't have to pay any sales tax on any of the equipment because we've got a special exemption in the sales tax code for that. We have a tax code that is filled up with every little industry carve-out based on who's good at coming to the Capitol with lobbyists and advocating for something. And there's no evidence that any of that actually creates anything positive as far as growth or jobs or anything else when you add it up. I mean, we could do an endless stream of industry-based targeted carve-outs from the tax code, but we're not going to have any stronger economy or more jobs total in the state at the end of that. So, there's a cool factor in filmmaking, but I think the question is whether that's a really good use of resources in the state, that we're supposed to spend millions of dollars because it's cool to make movies here. There's an existing industry, but industries come and industries go. The world changes, and the market's really good at allocating those resources, and Minnesota's state government isn't necessarily that good at it, especially the legislature. I think we're really lousy at figuring out what industries are good and which ones are weak. So, I mean, I appreciate your coming here. You've got a group of people to represent. I understand you're trying to be creative and save the industry. But from a policymaking standpoint, and certainly from a Republican standpoint, I can't understand why people wouldn't decide that the market's good at allocating resources. But, Representative Kahn, I'm not a tax and spend liberal. I consider myself more of a social capitalist. I think that we invest in people and education and all those kind of things and let the market be the market. And if we think it's a great idea to have films, Representative Erdahl's got legacy money that we can throw at movies that we want to make or do things through the Arts Board or other places. But the tax code's not a good place to sort those priorities out.
Representative Davids.
Can you repeat the question?
Representative Davids. Why? Why?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Winkler, if you're looking for consistency, please don't look at me.
Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let's respond a little bit to Representative Winkler. I certainly am a great believer in the free market system as well. But that only... In some areas, that depends upon, again, a level playing field. As long as the states around us are taking movies from us and taking business from us and taking tax income from us because of incentives that they offer, we no longer have a level playing field to deal with them. And therefore, the free market cannot operate in a free manner.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Davids, I think we studied fiscal notes in this committee, and I think I agree with Representative Simon in this case. I think the film board leverages a tremendous percentage versus the investment we put into it. It brings back into this Department of Revenue, I think it was tremendous. Can you tell us what is the return on our investment from the film board as far as when we get a play here with the film company spends how much and raises how much taxes? It's not demonstrated in the fiscal note, but it's certainly there.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Winter?
Chair Lanning and Representative Gunther. The simplest way to answer that would be to say that since we reignited the funding for Snowbait, modest though it is, since we reignited that in 2006, there's been an investment. There's been a return on, and I don't have my sheet here, but it's in the neighborhood of $6 million, I believe, $4 to $6 million. I don't have the exact figure, but I know the return on that has been, in terms of expenditures into the state, it's been $26 million and counting. And the FTEs created, we do have an FTE formula that we use that's approved by the state, and the FTEs have been about 300. And the ROI, if we want to look at it, we keep track of income taxes. We do not keep track of sales tax. It's just too tricky, and we don't have the capacity to do it, although we do look at every receipt over $25, and we can tell you where that money is spent in terms of zip code. But the return on investment in terms of cost per job is extremely reasonable. The cost per job on snowbait, depending on who's doing the math, is between $8,000 and $9,000 a job. When our public policy researcher, and I will be happy to leave this with the committee staff for the records, but the that is much better than the cost per job that we're generating in the state overall. In our industry, it far beats it. So if those are numbers I have in my head, I know that our cost per job is between 8 and 10, 8 and 9. We've brought in about $26 million and created about 300 FTEs. Just so people understand, so the Film Commission receives funding from the state. We've received $325,000 a year for the past few years. We had a dip under Ventura, but that's about the same amount we received in '99. We match that with private dollars, and our snowbait incentive program runs on a top of 5% administrative fee. So when we have a full-time person who administers snowbait for films that are over $1 million, we have an outside auditor that we pay for, because it's just to be careful. It's too much for our person in-house to do. So, and to Representative Kahn's point, the thing that I like about our program very much, and that I feel I can, as a taxpayer myself, can support this, absolutely no money leaves the checkbook here at the state until the economic activity has occurred and all the expenses that have been paid are verified. So this is an incentive that the reimbursement does not occur until all the economic activity has taken place. It's only Minnesota companies, Minnesota people who are being reimbursed on, unlike some other states, because we believe that's the way to build a program. You incent people to hire here, not to bring people in with them. And the same would be true with the production tax credit. The credits would be certified before production would begin, but no tax credits would be, they follow with your corporate taxes for the following year. You submit those certificates the following year. So the actual loss of income from the credit far lags the activity that occurred, which brought in new revenue, new tax, income tax dollars, sales tax dollars, all of those things.
Members, we have two folks on the list, and then we need to move on. Representative Leidiger. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I was just hoping that at some point a film would be made here called The Wealth of Nations, and maybe a biography of Adam Smith, and it would have a special screening for Republicans to find out what they really believe in.
Mr. Chairman, that was a bit harsh.
Well, for those who are watching at home, I hope you've noted that Republicans don't always agree with each other, nor do Democrats always agree with each other. So noted here today in our discussion. So is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard relative to this bill? Seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 2655 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Tax Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. The bill is moving to Tax Committee. Thank you, Chair Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Thank you, members, and thank you, Chair. Appreciate it.
We will now move to House File 1813. Yeah. Members, those of you that were not here when I made this announcement before, there is a new sheet that we're asking you to fill out. There are a couple of new items on that list that were not on the previous. So we would ask that you transfer, if you've made marks on the other, transfer them to this new one. And we need to collect those by today, by the end of our meeting. So if you would please do that so we can pass on our recommendations to the Capital Investment Committee. We will tally your input from all of the bills that have been before us and then send that on to the Capital Investment Committee. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me, Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on this topic, should our recommendations sum up to a particular total?
No, that's not necessary. And the Capital Investment Committee is going to have to make sure that the numbers work. And please put your name on these as well, so we have record that everybody has turned that in. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back before the committee today, has having passed out of this committee to go to the registrar, I asked for it to come back. There was a fiscal note in for the previous bill, and I have a delete all amendment today to address that.
Okay, do you want to, why don't you move the bill and then move the amendment?
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 1813 to pass and go to the register.
Representative Benson moves that House File 1813 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register, and you have a delete all.
Yes, thank you. I have a delete all amendment, and to get it in the shape that I'd like to get it in so that we can speak about it, I'd like to get that on first, and then I can speak to the differences between the second engrossment and the delete all amendment.
Is that that's a DE3?
The DE3.
So Representative Benson moves the DE3 amendment. Do you want to explain the amendment and then we'll act on it?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. If you've got the two laying next to each other, what I did or with the help of the agency admin, they already had a master contract that uses analytics or data regarding a number of different functions. It was part of the 12 areas that that were added for with RFPs that we got a report on actually in January. After a lot of conversation with the agency, what we have done in the delete all amendment is to add, if you look at line 1.5 in the delete all and it, compare that to 1.7, in 1.5 in the delete all, it says eligible contractors are going to sustain agencies in using data analytics too. So what we've done is, in effect, use the already existing contracts to provide for the information that's needed in order to get this program off the ground. Second, there's a little bit of wordsmithing. In 1.9, 1.11, and 1.9 on the DE, in 1.9 it speaks to bring about internal reorganization of management functions, flatten out, and the other one it says to bring about in order to flatten out organizational without including management. And the reason I bring the bill forward is to add the emphasis on making sure that that we're taking a look at with this data analytics contract, not only the functions that were delineated in the first 12, but making sure that there's a focus on looking at the overall management structure. So goes the management structure in many cases, so goes the functioning and vision of the actual organization. And does it change, it kind of narrows it down to management functions in the bill so that it's separate from the original data analytics RFPs.
Questions about the DE3 amendment? If not, in order to get the bill in the shape that the author prefers, all in favor of the DE3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. The DE3 amendment is approved. Representative Benson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We had a pretty good discussion in our last committee before exactly what this is trying to get out and to do. I don't know that I can add anything additional. Again, this coming back to the committee and adding the DE3 was out of the I'll coin a Representative Erdahl phrase and say peace in the valley, and taking a look at work that had already been done and to be able to utilize that so that we could eliminate the cost so it can go right to the register without going to waste means.
Questions from the committee? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify with respect to this bill? Anyone who wishes to testify, seeing none, and no discussion on the committee, do you want to renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I renew my motion that House File 1813
as amended,
pass and go to the register.
All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. The bill moves to the general register. Thank you, Representative Benson, and let's take your second bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House File 2327. Mr. Chairman, I'd ask that it pass and it would go to Ways and Means. There is a fiscal note.
Representative Benson moves that House File 2327 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Ways and Means. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a bill that comes from a lot of work in the Election Integrity Task Force. The task force labored on this specific issue for 2 or 3 months before arriving at consensus on items necessary to improve both the notification and the elimination of felon voting. Notification to felons, of course, that until their rights have been restored that they can't. And some changes in how they interact so as to make sure that they don't vote, and if they register, what happens, and change the penalty and the like. I'm going to read from an overview of points and ask Stan for questions, but we also have, and I have to apologize, a last-minute amendment, the A3 amendment that's being passed around that gets at some needed changes in order to make sure that I'll get to the amendment. I'll talk about the bill first, then I'll get to the amendment. So the overview, number one, in Section 1, invalid registrations notice to the voter requires a county auditor to notify a voter registration applicant of the applicant's need to reaffirm his or her eligibility to vote in writing if the county auditor has reason to believe that the applicant is not eligible to vote based on records provided to the auditor by another public entity. Section 2, prohibitions and penalty, affirmative defense, modifies the criminal penalty of an ineligible individual who registers to vote does not subsequently cast a ballot. In these cases, the penalty would become a misdemeanor offense, was a felony. If an ineligible individual registers to vote and subsequently does not cast a ballot at an election, the felony penalty established by current statute would continue to apply. The thought there, they're already felons, they've not been released, they don't have their rights restored. If they, in many cases, what we found is they're unaware of the fact that they can't. So they go to register thinking they can, and what happens is they get a second felony offense. The last thing that we want to do, if we can, is to send them back to prison at $90 a day and a lot of other reasons. But that's the reason behind eliminating that or reducing that from a felony to a misdemeanor. Paragraph B of the section establishes an affirmative defense, however, in a prosecution for registering to vote while ineligible. Defense would be available if the accused individual requested to withdraw the registration prior to the criminal charges being filed and the individual did not vote at an election between the time the registration was submitted and the time it was withdrawn. Number three, access to data requires the Commissioner of Corrections to provide electronic data to the Secretary of State on individuals on probation for a felony offense that would result in the loss of civil rights as indicated by the statewide supervision system. The Secretary of State is required to use the data to verify data contained in the statewide voter registration system and to direct county auditors to make updates to voter records on or contact the county attorney as appropriate. Data is transmitted to the Secretary of State in this matter or on individuals serving a felony sentence under the jurisdiction of the Commissioner of Corrections. The data transmitted would newly be required to include an individual's last known residential address that is not a correctional facility. Notice to the affected individuals requires that the Secretary of State provide a written notice to, one, an individual on probation for a felony offense that would result in the loss of civil rights, that registering to vote and voting on probation is itself a felony offense and may result in the loss of probation status, and, two, an individual has completed a term on probation with no new felony conviction, that the individual's right to vote has been restored. So notification processes. Subdivision 3 is the use of the data prohibits the Secretary of State from using or disseminating data received under the section for any purpose other than those authorized in the section of the statute. Number 4, investigations and prosecutions. Big change in this area requires a law enforcement agency to promptly investigate an alleged violation of the laws governing voter registration upon being notified by affidavit of the allegation. This replaces the current mandate that a county attorney promptly investigate and present the matter to a grand jury with whatever evidence is found. Actually placing it in the agency has the tools to actually do the investigation. Upon a determination of probable cause, the county attorney would be required to proceed in accordance with standards regarding the prosecution function as established by the American Bar Association Criminal Justice Section. A misdemeanor penalty and forfeiture of office for a county attorney who refuses or intentionally fails to faithfully perform the duties required by this section is eliminated. 5, delivery of ballots in Section 5 requires the Commissioner of Corrections to provide the Secretary of State with a list of names and mailing addresses of correctional facilities in which only persons convicted of felony-level offenses reside in Minnesota. Absentee ballot applications received with one of these addresses must be rejected and a copy forwarded to the county attorney. Department of Corrections is required to institute procedures to ensure that Minnesota absentee ballots are not received or mailed by offenders in one of these facilities. Number 6, unlawful voting penalty. Establishing that a signature, one of the things that we have most difficult on is proving intent. If we take one of these cases to court, accused says when they get into the testifying on the stand that they really honestly didn't know, it is terribly difficult to prove intent. But this would require, in this unlawful, establish that the signature of an individual on the polling place roster is prima facie evidence of the intent that the individual to vote at the election for purposes of criminal prosecution for unlawful voting. So we're going to go through a lot of notification. There's going to be a lot of new places that they can hopefully receive all the information they need in order to decide whether or not they've been restored or not. And this will now make sure that if they sign on the dotted line, then they are saying that they knew. Establishment of statewide supervision systems permits the Secretary of State to access adult data in the Corrections Department of Corrections statewide supervision system in conformity with the requirements established earlier in the bill. And number 8, lastly, probation supervision, notice of loss of voting rights. It requires adult felons placed on probation supervision to be notified in writing that the individual may not register to vote or cast a ballot at an election during the period of felony supervision. The notice is required to be contained in the probation agreement and contained in the individual's probation file, and the individual must acknowledge by signature receipt of the notice. Mr. Chairman and members, there was a lot of other recommendations, many of them that didn't require legislation, to make sure that we do the best we can to provide information to people that are still in some kind of supervision status, that they're not voting and they're not committing voter fraud or felony because they're voting when their rights have not been restored. One such is just simply that we're going to provide signs to the polling places that say that in a grander way than we have before. Our hope is that this will begin to address significantly this issue. With me today, I have Beth Frazier from the Secretary of State's office, and she can also add some additional information to the discussion. And
Mr. Chairman, we have an A3 amendment. Hopefully it's all been passed out now. If it's the proper time, I'd like to be able to discuss what that does to the bill.
Okay, do you want to move the A3 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move the A3 amendment.
Okay. Do you want to explain the A3 amendment, and then we'll act on it?
I guess the abbreviated version of it is that what we found that there's some conflict in terms of our notification process, that in the bill in its current shape would require that on a monthly basis information is shared and that notifications could be issued or letters sent out to felons saying their rights have been restored. However, if they were to reoffend 6 months prior to or 3 months prior to, they would have conflicting notifications because then you get a second notice out that would say you can't vote. So what this does is it gets to the process in saying that a month before,
60 days
before the actual election, the latest information about whether you can or you cannot vote would be mailed to either the person who has reoffended or their rights have been restored.
Any discussion on the amendment in order to get the bill in the shape that the author prefers? Can we consider the amendment then? All in favor of the amendment to get the bill in the shape the author prefers, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. The A3 amendment is adopted. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Benson. This is just more of a comment than anything. I am concerned that people would have their civil liberties restored 5-10 days before voting, and they're not just in the way the makeup is of notifying DOC to Secretary of State to the person, that they're not going to get proper notification on time. And as you know, we've talked offline about that, and I'm okay with proceeding on having DOC do some notification of restoration of rights and perhaps adopt that in the Senate version. But I just wanted to go on record that I am concerned that time lags prevent people from voting, and whatever we can do to help that or someone to legitimately cast a ballot. So that's all I wanted to say, and I'll be very happy to work with you in the Secretary of State's office.
And Mr. Chairman, I did speak with Representative Gauthier before our committee meeting. I'd be happy to sit down. I think we have some concern about just not having some redundancy, but certainly we can have that conversation. And as there is time in the Senate to still add and amend, I'd be happy to look at it and incorporate as we can.
Ms. Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Frazier with the Office of the Secretary of State. I just want to point out that in the amendment, it does require that the Department of Corrections provide us with a projected discharge date. So if somebody is supposed to be discharged between the time that they generate the list and the election, we would know that and would be able to tell them that, you know, assuming that you are discharged on your projected discharge date, you will be able to vote. So they will be receiving notice that should indicate that if they are discharged, they would be eligible.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say thanks, Representative Benson, for your work. This is a good effort and a bipartisan effort, I think. I think we all agree we don't want people who are ineligible to vote to vote. And by the same token, when they're kind of re-eligible, they should know that. And I think it's worth repeating what we discussed over the past year or so, that, you know, the vast majority, and in some cases 100%, of the unlawful voting that's gone on in Minnesota has been by felons who weren't supposed to vote but voted. According to one study, in the 2008 election, there were 38 felons in Minnesota who voted and weren't supposed to, either voted or registered and weren't supposed to. And in almost all those cases, as you and I have heard elsewhere, these are people who simply didn't know. This wasn't any plot or conspiracy by someone to get someone elected. This is someone who generally thought that they were out of prison and that was okay and they could vote, and then got sort of trapped in the system that you're trying to change here and make much more fair. So I hope going forward this is one problem that we can sort of take off our plate and people will be a lot better informed. So I appreciate it.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Benson. I want to thank you for your work on this bill, too. I think it is really important that people don't vote when they shouldn't, but should vote when they can. And I guess I would share some of Representative Gauthier's comments that, you know, I would like to make sure that Minnesotans are getting notified that their rights to vote are restored. And I know Ms. Frazier explained that process a little bit. I think that it gets difficult because a lot of people don't understand what that means to be discharged from their sentence, and they get confused. And there are people that have the right to vote and don't because they're afraid that they're going to commit a felony even though they are able to vote. So I hope that as we continue to work on this bill, we can make sure that that we're working on the section that would allow Minnesotans to be notified of their right to vote.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Frazier, it's the language on 1.11 says the county auditor has reason to believe, based on records, and then with this new DE, the A3 amendment that comes in, what about the election judges? How much information do they have when it comes time to the day of election and or prior to? How much notice are they given? I mean, do they? You can give me an explanation on it.
Ms. Frazier?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, this bill will help tremendously in ensuring that anyone who is pre-registered, who's been convicted of felony, that is flagged on the roster so that election judges will know. We currently, when we receive data from the courts, we search to see if the person is registered and flag the record if the courts have notified us they've been convicted of a felony. And since 2010, have been receiving some data from the Department of Corrections so that we could flag additional records. But to date, the current law only allows the Department of Corrections to provide us with people under the commissioner's jurisdiction, which are people who have been sent to prison, and it's only about 20% of the felon population. So this will allow them to send much more complete data so that we'll be able to flag additional people who should be flagged so that election judges will know it when somebody walks in that there is a question about their eligibility and that they need to stop before handing the person the ballot and ask them questions.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Frazier, it says something here about written notices going out to the individual. Will election judges have a copy of those that documentation to say, because someone could say, well, I've been out of prison or I've been out of jail for such and such, and even though you've got it flagged, I'm sure I can vote. And is there anything that can substantiate to allow the election judge to say, no, I've got a piece of paper here that's been signed by the Secretary of State or whoever, the DOC, that says, I'm sorry, but this correlates, so we got a backup verifying. Just asking.
Ms. Frazier?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the letters will not be provided to the election judges. And the way that the challenge procedure works is that individuals are allowed to, are put under oath and then asked questions. And it's made very clear to them that if they lie and vote when they're not eligible, that they're committing another felony, which I think serves as a pretty big deterrent, especially for people who have already been convicted of a felony. Part of the reason for that sort of process is there may be more than one Bruce Anderson, for example, in the state of Minnesota. And we want to be sure that if we flagged your record and it should have been somebody else's record, that you have the opportunity to cast a ballot.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Benson, I just have a simple question. I had someone refer to me about this report. Was this the same committee that Joe Nunez of Target Corporation, was he co-chair with you on this?
That's correct.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Representative Slavik.
Representative Benson, then, was the task force unanimous on this, or did you struggle with a lot of these issues? I mean, it's, you know how many reports we get here at the legislature, and this was one I just hadn't seen, and he brought it to my attention. I found it very interesting. Was it pretty unanimous at the end by the time you got done?
Representative Benson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. We
labored long on the list of things, and when we got to the end, this was all unanimous. This was a consensus on the things that we believe need to be in the bill.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard relative to this bill? Seeing that no one else wishes to be heard, Representative Benson, any final comments? And
yeah, I just thank you and the committee for hearing the bill. I think this is a big step forward in mitigating the circumstances that we've labored under in terms of felon voting. So I would just renew my motion that it pass and go to Ways and Means.
Representative Benson moves that House file, renews his motion that House file 2327 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to Ways and Means. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. The bill will move to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Benson. Next bill is House file 2194, Representative Gauthier. Representative Gauthier, do you want to move your bill and it'll be laid over as we're doing with all the other bonding?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'd like to move House File 2194 and have it laid over. Mr. Chairman and members, House File 2194 is a bill to help construction of a water system to deliver untreated water from the St. Louis River estuary to the Spirit Mountain Recreation Area in Duluth's West Hillside. Spirit Mountain currently uses treated city water for snowmaking operations. The replacement water system would be developed would accomplish two things. First, we would not use treated water to make snow, and there would be more capacity for the city's water system to serve residential and commercial industrial water needs. Secondly, the system would be designed to provide a means for water to flow back into the St. Louis River as the snow melts in the spring. This addresses concerns of Spirit Mountain regarding erosion and runoff, which need to be addressed. And this is something I believe that has been encouraged by the DNR. Today I have with me Renee Matson, the Executive Director of Spirit Mountain Recreation Authority, who can tell us a bit more about Spirit Mountain's water facility needs and improvements and why this bill is important.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Renee Matson, Executive Director at Spirit Mountain Recreation Area in Duluth, Minnesota. Chair Lanning, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to describe in more detail today House File 2194. As Representative Gauthier stated, the project we're proposing has multiple ways in which it benefits Duluth, our winter tourism economy, and ultimately Spirit Mountain, of course. The Grand Avenue corridor in West Duluth, which is anchored by Spirit Mountain, has been identified as a tourism corridor for future development. And with land currently being purchased around Spirit Mountain by private developers, which will support the vision, removing Spirit Mountain from Duluth's water system is a prudent move. But more important and frankly exciting aspect of the opportunity to put in place a system that not only delivers water in the fall, but returns that water runoff in the spring back to the St. Louis River through the same water pipes. It's a pretty unique system we're proposing. It thereby mitigates some of the erosion issues that have been caused by decades-long development along the I-35 corridor that contribute to the problem. This is a project we've been working on for more than 4 years, a project which already stated has the enthusiastic support of the Minnesota DNR, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the Soil and Water Conservation District, and also the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. We've already secured $1 million in grants with the help of the previously mentioned partners to complete the watershed study, the engineering, and the substantial groundwork that would go with this project. This bonding support would enable us to fully finish this important project and allow us to leverage our grant dollars for completion of the project. Spirit Mountain has a direct economic impact on the region of $37 million annually, which is a significant amount. And ensuring there is a viable water supply every fall is extremely important. With Duluth's aging infrastructure, this bond issue makes sense environmentally and also economically. I appreciate your time today to hear this, and I'd be pleased to answer questions if you have any.
Questions from the committee? Representative Moline.
Thank you, Representative Gauthier. And if I have this correct, it takes the water out of the St. Louis River?
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Gauthier. Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Representative, well, I guess if it's supported by the DNR, maybe they've done the studies, but at Luzon we're having the issue where we've taken the water out of the river and now the water's too low, so now we need money to take it out of Lake Superior. So I'm just wondering if you're sure that taking it out of the river is the best solution.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moline, this is something that's absolutely advocated very strongly by the DNR. And as you know, the St. Louis is probably the biggest river that flows into Lake Superior, and it is part of the Lake Superior estuary. I'm pretty confident, you know, that it's going to be a neutral effect because we're going to quit taking water out of Lake Superior and treating it. And we're going to be taking it out of the river before it hits the lake. And I understand your problems up at Lutzen, and that's why I supported you on that bill.
Ms. Mattson, did you wish to comment?
Yes. In response to that, 2 years ago, we did receive legislative authority to draw water from the St. Louis River. So that hurdle already has passed a couple of years ago. So we do have the authority.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard relative to this bonding proposal? If not, we will lay this over as we've done with the other bonding requests, and we'll be tallying our individual committee responses to all the proposals. Thank you, Representative Gauthier and Ms. Mattson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
members, please finish up your tally sheet here on all of these bonding proposals so that we can put that all together and forward it to the Capital Investment Committee. They want it from us this week, and so please do that. We do not have a need for a meeting either tomorrow or Thursday. But next week we'll be back at it again heavy with a whole bunch of bills that we will need to process next week. So with that, members, we stand adjourned.